Today I'm sitting here with Dr. Douglas Taran and Abby Stoika, my two supervisors, so this is really exciting for me. And Dr. Taran is the director of the Western Region Public Health Training Center, and Abby Stoika is the associate director for the training center. So can I just have you two explain to our audience a little bit about what the training center does, where the idea for this podcast came from, and why I've spent my whole summer doing this?
Well, you know, we've had the training center here for 8 years at least, and you know, we're here to strengthen the public health workforce, and we do it in all sorts of different ways. We do assessments for the county health departments and state health departments and tribal health departments, and we do lots of different types of trainings in person, with webinars, with online short courses. And you know, little by little, we create more and more courses, and more people take our trainings. And I think a year ago, at least 40,000 registrants were part of our courses.
Wow.
So it's sort of all behind the curtain. No one really sees it because it's online. And so we're not having huge conferences, but given that we work with Arizona, Nevada, California, Hawaii, and the U.S. Pacific Islands, there's lots of public health people out there who want continuing education. And so that's our goal. We're production people. We have expertise in public health, but we bring in the specialized people on specific topics.
Yeah, which is why I've had so many cool guests on the podcast, is because I've been talking to people who specialize in all different types of research. So what does your role include as the associate director for the training center?
Yeah, besides, I oversee all the activities of the training center. I help coordinate with our partners. We have partners in different states because we are the central office of the regional public health training center for HRSA Region 9, but it's basically like the southwestern region of the United States. So that includes Arizona, Nevada, California, Hawaii, and the U.S. affiliated Pacific Islands. And so we have community-based training partners in all of those states that are really the ones that go into the community and either organize in-person trainings or help create online trainings for their public health workforce.
Yeah, and you just got to go to Palau this summer. How was that?
Well, that was in like March, April. I went to Palau and Hawaii to meet with some of our partners.
Yeah, that's a fun part of the job. Well, today, since Dr. Taran, you primarily focus on maternal and child nutrition, and Abby, I know during your master's work here at the U of A, you really worked on how public health departments could play a role in strengthening local food systems. That's what we're going to be talking about today. So I'm really curious to just know, Dr. Taran, what your life was like before the training center and what kind of work you did within the United States and outside the United States. And can you tell us what's similar and different about public health issues that you've studied in both locations?
Well, when it comes to nutrition, I think what's interesting is food is very cultural. And so no matter where you work, people gather around food. And you know, there are places where there's food insecurity and different levels of it, and like where it's very extreme, where you have true malnutrition, undernutrition, when I've worked in other low-income countries. But then you have other issues of just the mental health issues related to being food insecure, like where's your next meal going to come from? You might always find food, but it is just a really burden on families when they don't have enough food. So you know, I started off as a WIC nutritionist with the Navajo Nation, and we're, you know, it's a food supplement program for pregnant women and infants and children. And you know, the ideas of you know, how to provide the right food for people, how to prepare the food correctly, and making sure they had enough food, and along with you know, trying to link that food to some of the nutritional issues they were having at that time, underweight, anemia, making sure they had foods that were high in iron, protein. So that's where I was coming from when I, you know, before I came to the U of A, is looking at food issues. Food programs overseas, you know, when we do give out food to low-income families or low-income countries, how do we target that so we just don't blanket a country with food and mess up their economy of that country? So those like entry criteria. If a child is underweight, yes, you should give them food because that will help them grow better. But you shouldn't just blanket food to everyone in a city or in a community. So that's some of the similarities and differences. But there's malnutrition in different ways. And the more you pull off sort of the pills of an onion, you might get rid of protein, energy malnutrition. But after you got rid of that, then you start seeing the micronutrient nutrition problems. Mm-hmm. So you're just going deeper and deeper into how to optimize health.
So how did you decide what populations to target? You said that you don't usually try to do a blanket intervention. Mm-hmm. So what is the research methodology behind trying to find which areas need help and which groups need help?
Well, for example, when I worked in Ethiopia on a World Food Program project, they do screenings first. They'll go out into the community and they'll take the weights and heights of everyone within the little districts or within the county type areas. And then you look at which ones have the highest prevalence rates of undernutrition. And then you target those geographic areas. And then within those geographic areas, you take weights and heights of the children, those who are underweight. Then it's those families that get the food supplements, not just everyone, but they get to be screened into the program.
Well, can you talk a little bit about how food security, food deserts, nutrition issues impact different populations, so rural versus urban, and what can we do as public health professionals to kind of fix that issue that we're seeing?
So, you know, when you bring up food deserts, I mean, we first had to figure out what that definition is.
Yeah.
So, you know, traditionally, it's not having a supermarket place where you can get fresh fruits and vegetables within a certain distance from where you live. And that distance is really critical. You know, in urban areas, we often will say it's not within, you know, 1 or 2 miles of where you live. But in a rural area, you may not be able to get to a store that has fruits and vegetables. It might be 20 miles before you can do that. And so that's clearly, it's a food desert. The person might live in a food desert, but it's also they're living in a very rural area where that's probably not practical. The food deserts is that when people can't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables and they have limited incomes, they're going to buy the least expensive calories. And so they will go and they'll buy a fast food restaurant, you know, a hamburger and french fries maybe for $3 or $4.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had access to fresh fruits and vegetables, they might be able to buy, you know, 2 or 3 meals of fresh fruits and vegetables for the same amount. They can buy the squash, they can buy oranges, apples, things that are more nutrient dense and maybe have less, you know, calories in them at the same time. So I think when you live in a food desert, you change your behavior in order to adapt to where you live.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can prevent having a food desert, then people's behaviors will be changed automatically. So this is where this idea of supply and demand, actually supply, if the right supply, can change demand.
So how do you change a food desert?
Well, this is where policy comes in public health. I mean, mm-hmm. How do you provide a enterprise zone for food? You know, we already have some laws, some policies that help. You know, we don't tax food. Mostly there's not a sales tax for food. So, but why can't you do that for just total companies? Why can't you do that for farmers markets where, mm-hmm. you know, you can set up land for someone to actually sell food and not have to pay the monthly fee for that little kiosk table that they're using as a public service? So, you know, because the farmers, when they go to a farmers market, usually do pay as a rent to, mm-hmm. to sell something. So it's because it has to be more community organized than to say, let's do this as a community. There needs to be, you know, relatively good incentives for markets to open up. And they don't have to be big supermarkets. In some countries, such as Mexico, 30, 40 years ago, which is not that long ago, 80% of all the food was bought in open markets. Now 80% of the food is bought in supermarkets.
Wow.
So it really has changed very rapidly over a 30-year period. And so you have to figure out how do you – and that there's good things and bad things about that. But there's the idea about how do people get access to the food and who controls that food supply. The other ways to do it is mobile food markets. Mm-hmm. We have many of those now. We have produce on – what is it? Powwow? I forget the name of the company that does it.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about, but I don't know the name.
That might be the name, actually.
Yeah.
It's just I don't understand why
produce
that's the name.
Produce on wheels?
Yeah.
Yes. So now we have produce on wheels that gets food out into communities. We have the ugly food market, which is the ugly fruits and vegetables that aren't exactly perfect for a supermarket, but nutritionally, taste, they're wonderful. So we just had to be more open to alternative ways of getting food.
When you were a WIC nutritionist, where did you live? Tuba City?
Tuba City, up by the Grand Canyon, north of Flagstaff.
What was your food access like there?
Well, that's really interesting. In Tuba City, when I lived there, there was a couple trading posts where you could get food. They had very few fruits and vegetables. And when they had it, they weren't very well preserved. They were wilted, let's say lettuce or something. And so the owners of the trading posts were very hesitant to buy a lot to sell because it would go bad. That's one of the things about fresh fruits and vegetables. There was a supermarket that was built while I was there, which was really interesting, became super popular. Otherwise, I was required to drive 60 miles to Flagstaff to buy my food.
Oh, my goodness.
And what was really interesting at the time, a side note, is that one year, this was during the time when the oil prices went up in the U.S., and all of a sudden, I got a notice from the federal government that my rent went down. And I thought that was a mistake, and because I've never had my rent get decreased while I was living someplace. And they told me that it went down because when you lived in government housing, they prorated it based on how much it would cost you to go to the next town to buy your groceries.
Mm, that's really interesting.
And so all of a sudden my rent went down because if I had to go to Flagstaff to buy food, I was going to be spending more money to get to Flagstaff because gas prices were going up.
Wow. So how often would you go to Flagstaff to buy your groceries?
Every week or two.
Okay. Yeah. I would just be curious because I would think if I have to drive 60 miles, I'm going to do it less frequently. Mm-hmm. But then if you're grocery shopping less frequently, you're going to want to buy things that last longer.
Yeah. That's right.
Which are not fruits and vegetables.
And also, I had the advantages of having a refrigerator.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of the people who live on the Navajo Reservation then and even now don't have always access to lots of electricity or a refrigerator. When I worked in New York State for doing nutrition surveillance work for the state of New York, we would do these surveys and we would ask people if they have a stove or if they have a refrigerator for preserving food and cooking. But we also had to ask a second question, does it work?
Yeah.
Because often someone says, I have a refrigerator, but I use it as more of a thermos than a working refrigerator because they were maybe very low-income rural populations in upstate New York. And it's really interesting that people who produce food often are the people who sometimes are the least food secure because they have the lowest incomes.
Yeah. It just makes me realize, I mean, I knew it before, but so privileged just to be able to live someplace where if you forgot something at the grocery store, you can run back and get it.
Yeah.
Like, if you are driving 60 miles and you forgot, you know, onions or something, then that's just like, there's 2 weeks without something you wanted. Dr. Taryn, you wear a bunch of different hats here at the University of Arizona. So you're the director of the training center here, you're associate dean, you also teach some courses, and you're basically involved in a lot of different stuff here at the Mellon Enid Zuckerman College of Public Health. But you also do a lot of work in the community. So I know that you've worked in the past at the food bank. How do you incorporate your various roles here at the U of A when you're working out in the community?
Well, actually, it's quite easy because especially with the Community Food Bank of Southern Arizona, we have lots of students who work there, who do their internships there. We write grants together. So it's sometimes very hard for me to differentiate what I'm doing as a citizen with the food bank and what I'm doing as a faculty member at the food bank or what I'm doing as a member of their board of directors. And so even within the food bank, I have to wear three different hats. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I have to say, you know, as a board member, this research shouldn't be done this way because this isn't in the best interest of our clients. We don't want to burden our clients too much. Mm-hmm. And then as a researcher, I'll say, well, it would be really nice if we could do this and this. And so you have to really balance it all out.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that makes it easy is sort of the focus that a College of Public Health has and any community organization around issues like social justice or health equity. And we all have the same goals and objectives to have a healthy community, and that makes it a little bit easier too. So it's just a matter of finding the right projects and the right perspectives and bringing in what I think we have a great group of students all the time. And it's not just me as a nutritionist, but no, environmental health people have worked with the food bank. We've had people work on physical activity, community organizing, advocacy. So we have faculty and students who are always working in those areas. And so it's really just almost, I wouldn't even say an extension. It's just that we all work together.
Yeah, it's nice to work in a place where everyone is working towards the same goals. Abby, I know that you did some school garden work. What did you do for the school gardens as a public health intervention and learning tool?
Yeah, so when I was a graduate student, I did a part-time AmeriCorps position at Monzo Elementary School here in Tucson. And that, the first year was really actually more, it wasn't much public health work, I would say. I mean, I feel like no matter what, when you have a school garden, there's going to be some public health benefits to it. But my role that year specifically was more in terms of integrating the garden into classroom learning. So using it as an experiential education tool. So that students could, like, learn practical uses and fun ways to do classroom learning. So that could be, like, using egg production to teach graphing, something like that.
That's really fun.
And then the second year, I was working on my master's project for the university. And so then I was looking at the effect of garden exposure on different factors that would be related to student stress, mental health.
Yeah, I think that'd be fun as an elementary school student to kind of watch the whole cycle. We got really specific talking about Southern Arizona, so I want to take it a step back since the audience for this podcast is HRSA Region 9. I think we're an interesting region because we do include the U.S. Associated Pacific Islands. And when Dr. Ernst was here and she was talking about climate change, she was saying that the way we talk about climate change in the continental U.S. is completely different than the approach we need to take for citizens that live on the island, because, you know, the advice that we may give people in the U.S., the continental U.S., is just not applicable for somebody living on an island. Is that true for nutrition issues as well, and food production and food systems and, you know, farm to table, everything related to food?
My experience out in Micronesia and in Saipan is that the climate change is occurring there, but what's really a bigger issue is their lack of their own food production. Some of these islands are so isolated, they're importing lots of food, and they have lost some of the on-island food production. And it's interesting, because some of the concepts we have done looking at the past is, if you ask someone about, you should go back and grow your own pineapples, which are actually very water intensive, or bananas, or other tropical food that's already available, it's almost like saying, you're asking us to go back to a pre-economy culture where we can't really survive that way. But at the same time, the foods they import may be safe because there's food safety issues, which is good, but they also aren't their traditional foods, and they aren't necessarily balanced in the food that they get. I had a colleague who was really trying to expand the types of bananas being grown in Micronesia, and as you know, bananas may become extinct in the world pretty soon with a fungus that's out there devastating plants.
I did not know that.
Yes.
Wow, I'm shocked.
And, because we basically have one strain of bananas that we eat in the world. We don't eat a lot of those small red bananas that you see. So the other issue with climate change on the islands is really the rising water tides. The Marshall Islands could become totally underwater if the oceans keep rising. So you're going to lose another whole country, you know, civilization almost, if you could think of it that way, because they're all going to have to leave their island and go someplace else. What I've been really thinking a lot about is really our socioeconomic status that decides our microbiome. Because our microbiome isn't just, you know, what we eat. It starts at birth. You know, if you're having a C-section or coming through the birth canal, you get babies get exposures to different microbiomes. If they be breastfed, it's a different exposure to microbiome versus being bottle-fed. Then you even have just where you live, what's in the air, because there's microbes everywhere. It's not just what you consume. So, and given your economic status, what you eat is dependent on your socioeconomic status too, as we spoke about mm-hmm. earlier. So socioeconomic status, again, we were talking about privilege. People who are able to have a diverse diet because of privilege are able to eat differently.
Yeah. So over the past couple of decades, we've really seen this rate of childhood obesity increase significantly in the United States. How much of that has to do with nutrition, and what can we do about it as public health professionals?
The increase in childhood obesity is occurring for multiple reasons, and diet is definitely one of them, and physical inactivity is another one. As a matter of fact, if you look at some of the National Health and Nutrition Examination data, you'll see that the total energy intake of people in the U.S., especially I know in men, hasn't increased all that much, but yet weight has increased. So if you're not eating more and weight's increasing, it means you're being less active. And so we need to think more about children being physically active. As a matter of fact, I just met with our Pima County Health Department yesterday about increasing physical activity in children around bicycling. And they have an amazing bicycling program already going on in Pima County with the health mm-hmm. department in middle schools and trying to get kids to be more active. Mm-hmm. And what's really interesting about that is, and we sort of all agree that when people bicycle, it's not just giving them physical activity for energy balance so they don't get overweight, but they tend to be happier, they have more self-confidence. It's going to create a lot of different types of outcomes for children. At the same time, we need to be able to make sure that children just don't sit around and munch all the time yeah. on high-calorie foods. I was listening to a news article the other day about, or maybe I was reading it, I can't quite remember, about a person who was working with overweight children, and the person said the children's diets were really good. The children came in and said, no, Monday through Friday, I'm doing fantastic. I'm following the diet. But Saturday and Sunday, we just play video games mm-hmm. and we eat all weekend. And so they basically negate 5 days of hard work with 2 days of video gaming. And they're not getting outside.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to create those environments, those parks and recreation environments. And they don't have to be always competitive sports, just being out and having fun.
Yeah.
I remember when my daughter went to Tucson High School, they had an urban hiking class. So basically, their physical activity class was, let's just go out and walk down Fourth Avenue, go downtown, and walk for the hour and do some urban hiking. And that was just fine. That's exactly what we want kids to be able to enjoy. Know that when they're outside, they can have a good time.
I think there can be similarities with what we talk about with physical activity and nutrition, though, in terms of like considering how built environment of a neighborhood can really limit the physical activity opportunities for children in certain neighborhoods as well as food options.
Yeah, can you talk about the built environments a little bit more and define that for people who might not? I just found out about it like 2 years ago. So,
yeah, I mean, in terms of what resources are available in a neighborhood, things like parks, other recreational opportunities, whether they have sidewalks, whether it's a walkable environment, is there a lot of crime, is there shade on the street, things that are really going to contribute to whether someone wants to be outside and whether it's safe to be outside.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. When we built Drachman Hall, where our College of Public Health is, you notice that all our stairs are outside.
Yeah.
We don't have any inside stairs. We don't have any stairwells, mm-hmm. per se. And that was to make the stairs more inviting for people to walk up to the second floor or third floor. That was intentional.
I did not know that.
There was also some other issues, like it was safer. We didn't want any women to be, like, inside a stairwell at night by themselves. So we figured it was safer and invited people to walk up the steps. And we're lucky in Tucson that the climate is such that in December, January, you can still walk outside and up the steps.
Yeah, we don't have to worry about icy stairs here.
In July and August, do you want to?
Yeah, nobody is ever taking the stairs in July and August. It's
I feel like
hot.
In Tucson, we actually have the problem more so where there's like no shade on the streets and there's no sidewalks in a lot of neighborhoods. And so you don't want to walk because it's just too hot.
So many teachers feel bad taking their kids out for recess because it's just so hot outside.
Yeah.
And so you have to come up with alternate ways to get kids to maybe have an activity in a gym or in a cooler environment. But July and June and August in Tucson is not fun.
And I feel like food too, like after I first moved here and I was gardening a lot, I started gardening at home. So I was growing things and trying to grow things in summer. And after a couple years, I was like, no, I'm not going to grow things in summer anymore. Like, that's when a lot of people, I feel like, take their time off gardening here because it's so water intensive during the dry season and so hot.
Yeah, it's just hot to be outside.
The other thing about, you know, getting kids thinking about their food is helping them learn how to cook. I think one of the real deficits that has occurred in the U.S. over the last 20 or 30 years is people don't know how to prepare food anymore. Lots of people don't cook. A lot of people just go to the market and you can buy prepared food now that is relatively less expensive. And so they haven't learned how to cook at home. So if you want to make low-calorie substitutions, it's hard for people to know how to do it. You know, how do you take a squash and roast a squash? Well, you just put it in the oven, you turn on the oven, and in 30 minutes it's cooked. But people don't even know something that simple sometimes. They've never tried it.
Yeah.
And doing something new is always risky because if you're low, especially if you're low income and you just spent $3 or $4 on some food, you want to make sure that when you prepare it, it's edible afterwards.
Yeah,
and
you're
not going to take the risk that it's not going to work out.
Yeah.
And so, because there's lots of good ways to substitute calories with other types of foods. So, again, we talked about vegans and vegetarians, but now we have gluten-free, we have low carbs, the keto diet. You know, how do you make those substitutions where they're still healthy?
Yeah.
So how do you substitute pasta? Well, you use maybe spaghetti squash, but how do you use spaghetti squash? Someone has to know how to cook it correctly.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Taryn and Abby, thank you so much for not only being on the podcast, but supporting it throughout this whole summer. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.